Great. Well, thank you so much for giving me the chance to speak. So I'm going to tell you about some recent work in collaboration with Christian Jensen, work that has recently appeared, as well as some work in progress, and some of the conceptual underpinnings of these projects were discussed in a recent paper with Andy Strominger. Well, not so recent, about a year old. So let me begin with some questions. So one interesting question is, do the postulates of quantum mechanics survive in quantum gravity? So our main tools for quantum gravity include the gravitational path integral and its Hamiltonian formulation, string theory, and various other methods and techniques. And these techniques each produce states and transition amplitudes. Part of their formalism, part of their output are states and transition amplitudes, particularly any formalism which is based on the path integral in one manner or another. However, something to keep in mind is that unitarity is not guaranteed in the path integral and must be checked. So even though the simplest versions of the path integral that one learns, for instance, in an introductory course in quantum mechanics, that we learn that there is an equivalence between the Schrodinger equation and the path integral, it is the case that in richer contexts, such as quantum gravity, and even more generally in effective field theory, one has to check explicitly whether the path integral is unitary. So actually, maybe I'll monitor the, I see, okay, good. Sorry, I saw something in the chat, but yeah. So let me know if there are any questions, or feel free to either put it in the chat or just to unmute yourself and you can ask the question in real time, however you prefer.
Question?
Yeah, he has a question.
Why should we think that the path integral for cosmology should be unitary?
Why do we think it should be?
Yeah, we're outside the system, so there's no counting the states outside the system.
I guess I'll run on.
Yes. Well, if you by virtue of your question, I gauge that you might be sympathetic to my cause, in the sense that I do not anticipate that there should be unitarity in cosmology. I'm setting up the question, as a skeptical question that one should be skeptical of, as is yours. But what we're really going to explore in this talk, in some concrete models, is the manner in which, in some concrete ways, we can see how, in particular, there is a lack of unitarity in certain tractable models of quantum cosmology. So indeed, there will not be unitarity in the conventional sense, or it'll manifest itself in an interesting way. And we will explore a concrete way in which that skepticism against unitarity is realized. So the other question here is, there are classical initial conditions which crunch in gravity coupled to matter, for example, or even just pure gravity itself. And the question is, for these kinds of classical initial conditions, what is their fate in quantum gravity? So we can imagine, for instance, that we have some initial conditions I, and that upon evolving them, that they terminate in some kind of crunch. Or conversely, if we have some final state and evolve it backwards, we might find that we begin in some kind of big bang, which can also be singular. So there have been various suggestions about such states over the years. One form of suggestion, which I'll attempt to make precise later on, is that such kinds of states should be excised or ruled out of the bulk Hilbert space. A particularly dramatic version of this is that the potential belief that the Hilbert space of De Sitter quantum gravity, the bulk Hilbert space, is actually finite dimensional in accordance with, for example, the Gibbons-Hawking formula. But regardless, there have been ideas floating around over the years that maybe these crunch geometries or these crunch states should be ruled out for some reason. However, these initial conditions a priori correspond to seemingly valid asymptotic states in the De Sitter S matrix. Namely, it seems perfectly fine a priori to prepare asymptotic states that correspond to smooth and very reasonable field configurations, which nonetheless will crunch at finite times. So there's some inherent tension between these two suggestions insofar as one believes them. And one way out of this is that one could stipulate that maybe the bulk Hilbert space and the asymptotic Hilbert spaces are somehow inequivalent to one another. This is a slightly odd suggestion, and one would have to figure out what is the manner in which the bulk and asymptotic Hilbert spaces could be incompatible and yet still have reasonable S-matrix amplitudes in De Sitter quantum gravity. Another suggestion, which may or may not be related, is that perhaps the evolution of quantum gravity projects out certain kinds of undesirable initial states that lead to invalid bulk geometries corresponding to crunches. I mention these not in particular proposals, but just suggestions that we should take as ideas that have been floated in various ways throughout the years. So what we are going to do in this talk is explore these two questions in some concrete models. But to do so, we need a framework for De Sitter quantum gravity to even be able to stipulate concrete answers to these questions. So for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to consider two simple models. One is De Sitter Jacquive Teitelbaum gravity, which is a type of low dimensional gravity, namely in 1+1 space-time dimensions, for which we have non-perturbative control over the amplitudes. I will also consider, with an eye towards generalizing to full-fledged Einstein gravity, as an initial attempt, we'll consider Einstein gravity with a positive cosmological constant in a mini superspace truncation. We will see that many of the features of the Jacquive Teitelbaum analysis will persist in the mini superspace truncation of Einstein gravity. And I will later comment more broadly as to what happens when we go to the more realistic setting outside of a mini superspace truncation and consider full-fledged Einstein gravity in and of itself. But we will get there in turn. Now, let me foreshadow the main results of the talk, at least at a conceptual level, and we'll see how they're instantiated at a technical level as we go. But at least in De Sitter Jacquive Teitelbaum gravity, we will see that evolution from the bulk to the infinite future is isometric, not unitary. So this also harmonizes with a certain perspective advocated with this paper last year with Andy Strominger. So here's a certain picture that you can imagine. We have this asymptotic Hilbert space of initial states in the far past that we are mapping using the S matrix U into the far future. And this can be viewed as a composition of a map, which I'll call V dagger, as we'll see why in a moment, from the past asymptotic Hilbert space to the bulk Hilbert space, composed with V, which maps us from the bulk Hilbert space to the asymptotic Hilbert space, such that this V operator, that VV dagger is equal to the S matrix, and V dagger V is equal to the identity. That is, this V is an isometry. It is an object such that VV dagger is equal to U, which in this case is a projection, but V dagger V is equal to the identity. We'll unpack this in a moment, but the salient point is this, that the S matrix from the far past to the far future is not a unitary, but is in fact a projection onto a subspace. So in other words, it is not something which unitarily evolves all of the states in the past to all of the states in the future, but rather it projects out many of the states. And we will see why it does this. One of the upshots of this, or one of the reasons why this works, is that we will see that in this model, the bulk Hilbert space and the asymptotic Hilbert spaces are inequivalent. And this can be viewed as one of the reasons as to why the De Sitter S matrix is not unitary, but in fact is a projection. But we'll unpack this in great detail. What's interesting is that this analysis follows from a sum over smooth metrics, which can be done non-perturbatively in low dimensions. And moreover, we'll find some initial evidence that this picture is substantiated in Einstein gravity. I should say initial evidence, not conclusive evidence. So let me proceed in the following manner. The talk will be divided into three parts. The first part will be a discussion of calculations in De Sitter Jacquive Teitelbaum gravity, which will be the longest part of the talk. I'll then proceed to generalize the analysis to a mini superspace truncation of Einstein gravity, and then we'll conclude with some discussion and some speculative remarks at the end. And I will also make three spontaneous asides throughout the talk, if you permit me. So let's begin with De Sitter Jakive Teitelbaum gravity. So here is the action for De Sitter Jakive Teitelbaum gravity. It is a theory of gravity in 1+1 space-time dimensions. So let's unpack what it is. Here we have a term proportional to the Euler characteristic, which essentially is like a genus counting type per object. But now here, this is the main meat of JT De Sitter gravity. We have here a non-dynamical dilaton, which serves as a Lagrange multiplier to enforce that the bulk curvature is set equal to 2. That is, that we are looking at Lorentzian manifolds with constant positive curvature. This is the sense in which we're looking at De Sitter gravity in two dimensions. Here we have a boundary term, a lower dimensional analog in this model of the Gibbons-Hawking-York term, has a certain kind of counterterm to soak up divergences. And we can regard this as the boundary term which is required in order to render this action as having a well-posed variational principle. Now, this action furnishes global DS2 geometries as the solutions to its equations of motion. Here is a way of visualizing the simplest of the solutions. This here is the De Sitter metric for global space-time in 1+1 dimensions. And here is the profile of the dilaton, where phi naught can take either be positive or negative. So here, x should be regarded as an angular coordinate. The spatial slices of 1+1 De Sitter are circles. So this is why this coordinate is periodically identified. On the other hand, we have this alpha squared parameter. We have this here. And we can think about alpha is related to the circumference of the minimal spatial geodesic. In particular, the circumference, which is here visualized in red, is 2 pi times alpha. So here, as alpha gets bigger, this corresponds to global geometries with a fatter bottleneck. Now, this model of low-dimensional quantum gravity has no propagating degrees of freedom. That is, it only has boundary gravitons, which are captured in the theory by Schwarzian modes, for those who are familiar with the model. But nonetheless, it possesses a non-trivial moduli space of bulk geometries, which we need to integrate over with an appropriate measure. So the theory, although it does not contain dynamical gravity in the bulk, namely propagating gravitons, it does still have a moduli space and also boundary gravitons, which provide some of the residual richness of the model, even though it's rather simple. So let me tell you some of the basic trappings of the model or the basic other ingredients. We would like to give boundary conditions on the model in the far future. So what do the boundary conditions look like at large t? Well, if we do a shift of the t-coordinates, there's a canonical way of writing the asymptotic behavior at large time. These are our analog of asymptotically De Sitter boundary conditions. And moreover, we stipulate that the dilaton goes to some profile, e to the phi of x, at large time. That is, we can characterize the boundary states with an arbitrary dilaton profile. So I'll write our final state as e to the phi. So at least naively, our Hilbert space of final states are parameterized by the dilaton profile at future infinity. Now, it turns out that one of the other basic objects of Jakive Teitelbaum gravity is an object which computes the geometry starting at the bottleneck and terminating in the far future, where we integrate over the fluctuations of the boundary graviton. So the boundary graviton is parameterized by this function f, where f has this type of periodic identification and identification under translations. We can regard f as being an element of diff s1 mod u1 for when alpha is not equal to 1. You don't have to worry about this so much. These are just details that go into actually the machinery of computing quantities in De Sitter Jakive Teitelbaum gravity. So we can visualize the trumpet in the following way. We have this f of x, which parameterizes the boundary wiggles, it parameterizes the boundary gravitons. And we have this alpha parameter here, which can be seen here, which is parameterizing the size of the bottleneck. And the way that one computes amplitudes is by gluing together a past-facing amplitude with a future, a past trumpet with a future trumpet, and integrating over this alpha in this manner. This is kind of high level. Again, one doesn't have to worry about this. This will be what is going on under the hood of some of the calculations that I will describe. So the desired ingredients for our story are fourfold. We need an asymptotic Hilbert space. We need the de Sitter S matrix. We need the bulk Hilbert space. And then we would like a way of relating the bulk in asymptotic Hilbert spaces, namely a bulk to asymptotic map, which I will notate by V. So what we need to describe these Hilbert spaces is not just a basis of the Hilbert spaces, but actually we need inner products on each Hilbert space to actually fully flesh out their data. So in other words, a Hilbert space is not just, of course, a complete basis, but we also need to know what is the inner product on vectors which lie in the Hilbert space. So let's do that. We will initially pursue the asymptotic Hilbert space, which is the trickiest case. So here is how we compute the asymptotic Hilbert space, or rather ascertain what it is, and then compute its inner product. So as I previously advertised, the putative Hilbert space in the far future, our initial guess as to what it might be, is the span of these states which are labeled by the dilaton configuration in the far future. So the picture that we would like to have in our heads is how we can compute inner products of these kinds of states is as follows. Suppose that in the very far future, we have a final state, which I will label by e to the phi 1, meaning that we end in a dilaton configuration that goes like e to the phi 1. And that at a slightly earlier cutoff slice down here, we are going to have some initial state that begins at with a dilaton configuration e to the phi 2. Now, if we compute an amplitude from this cutoff, from the bottom cutoff slice to the top cutoff slice, and we take the limit as both of those slices approach infinity and approach each other, that should compute for us the inner product. In particular, if we look at the amplitude from e to the phi 2 to e to the phi 1, and the limit that the two surfaces coincide, namely that the amount of time evolution between them is infinitesimal, then that will just merely compute the inner product between those two states. Now, however, what's interesting is that when one does this in quantum gravity, this calculation is actually a bit subtle because there are non-trivial moduli that one still has to integrate over. To elucidate this point, let's expand the metric in the far future. So if we expand the metric at large times, then we have this leading expansion, this leading term in the warp factor, this e to the 2t, which comes from the exponential de Sitter growth of the spacetime. But now we have a subleading term, which is this 1/2 alpha squared. Where in the global geometry, the alpha squared was associated with the bottleneck. And as such, alpha squared was forced to be positive to have a non-singular geometry. But here we see that in the asymptotically far future, the modulus that's associated with alpha squared plays a different role. In particular, as t goes to infinity, the sign of these moduli, in particular this alpha squared modulus, becomes unrestricted. That to say in a different way, in the limit as t goes to infinity, this first term becomes very, very large. And as it tends to infinity, there's actually no issue with making this alpha squared term negative. In fact, arbitrarily negative as well as being positive. When one is careful, it turns out that this gives you the prescription for computing inner products on the asymptotic Hilbert space, where you glue together this past slice and this future slice, and where you fill in the middle of the geometry, but now you actually integrate over all alpha squared, since that is what is prescribed by the expansion of the metric in the far future, namely that the modulus, which is given by alpha squared, has to be integrated over the entire real line and not just the positive real line. So the upshot of this is that when we do this computation, we find that there is a simple inner product on the asymptotic states. So let me explain what this is. Here, phi is related to e to the phi 1 and e to the phi 2 in the following manner. So if we look at phi inverse, namely the reciprocal of phi, this is just the zero mode of e to the minus phi. And this s is related to these little calligraphic phis by e to the phi times phi prime squared. So what we find from this inner product is that our asymptotic states are actually, our naive asymptotic Hilbert space actually has null states under this inner product. In particular, if we consider any state of this form, such that phi 1 and phi 2 have the same zero mode. I'm going to refer to this object as their zero mode. It's really the zero mode of their of each of the minus calligraphic phi, but I'm going to refer to it as the zero mode for convenience nonetheless. So if this little phi 1 and little phi 2 have the same zero mode, then this object is in fact a null state. It has zero inner product with itself under this inner product. So what this actually tells us when one deals with it carefully is that we should identify, so the way that we usually deal with Hilbert space is that we consider Hilbert spaces modulo their null states. The physical states are the states in the naive Hilbert space modulo the null states. So what this prescribes that we do is that we associate each of these e to the phi's by an equivalence class with an equivalence class, which is labeled by this phi zero mode. What this means is that the asymptotic Hilbert space is, in fact, the span of states labeled by these zero modes, where this big phi can range over all R, all the real line, and that this, in fact, is isomorphic to just L2 of R. So this might seem a little bit abstract, but let me give you the physical reason why this happens. So there's a physical reason for the appearance of these null states that you can see by just considering gravity even at a classical level. It turns out that there's a diff-S1 family of large diffeomorphisms which preserve the asymptotic metric but do not preserve the profile of the dilaton. In particular, there's a diffeomorphism which changes the profile of the dilaton but in fact preserves its zero mode. Since the diff-S1 large this family of large diffeomorphisms change the profile of the dilaton but preserve the zero mode, this suggests that we should that what we expect actually in the quantization is that we should view two different bulk boundary states as being equivalent if in fact they correspond to little phis with the same zero mode. And in fact, this is exactly what we find in our quantum analysis. So I just want to observe that we could have anticipated this structure of null states from the gravity point of view, but it's recapitulated and confirmed by the quantum analysis.
It's a comment, because what you construct seems to be very much related to what we call the physical inner product, which in fact is basically the path integral evolution between two states. And then it's known that that is supposed to project onto the states satisfying the constraints. Meaning, indeed, that the things which you project out are poorly gauged. So can I summarize that as the kind of boundary, these boundary modes, except the null modes, are indeed gauged?
Yeah, that's right, in the sense that they can be removed by large diffeomorphisms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. So the physical, if you will, the physical degrees of freedom are kind of characterized by the zero modes. The physical states are only characterized by the zero modes. That's right. Yeah, I agree with your characterization.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay, so far we have our ingredients for the asymptotic Hilbert space, and we have this nice inner product. And if they're almost delta function normalized, except for these prefactors, but if we take each of the states and we rescale them, we can get rid of these pesky prefactors. So let me do so for convenience. Great. Now let's turn to the de Sitter S matrix. So we would like to compute these S matrix elements where we start in a state phi 2 and we end in a state phi 1. And we can do this in this JT gravity model by soldering together a past trumpet, which is given by the Z star of alpha squared object, with a future trumpet, and then integrating over alpha squared, namely integrating over non-singular geometries in which the bottleneck has positive circumference. And when we do so, this is the answer that we find. The I epsilon comes, by the way, from the I epsilon prescription is required so that this moduli integral converges. That's where the I epsilon comes from. Now, this this may jump out at you as being a familiar expression. This is a particularly familiar object, namely its Fourier transform is very familiar to us. To bring out its Fourier transform, it's convenient to work in a conjugate basis. Instead of working in terms of these zero modes phi, let's work in terms of these P states, which are like the Fourier conjugates to phi. So that is, instead of working with phi 2 and phi 1, we'll work with P2 and P1s. And in that basis, the S matrix is particularly simple. It is just the Heaviside step function that projects us onto positive P's. This, importantly, is not a unitary operator. It is an operator which takes half of the states in the asymptotic Hilbert space, namely those P's which are negative, and it projects them out. This is not a map from the far past to the far future, which preserves all the states. It is a projector, which only projects us onto the states with positive P. So that's the next ingredient of our story. So here, let's rewrite the asymptotic Hilbert space in terms of the P basis so that everything matches up. So here is the P basis. And now in this P basis, we see that the de Sitter S matrix is not a unitary, but it's a projector. It's very, very simple, but nonetheless, it's a projector. So now let's talk about the bulk Hilbert space. So a bulk analysis will help us explain where the projector comes from. So what we can do is, if we gauge fix the bulk in this manner by working in a temporal gauge, then we realize that we can write the JT action just as a simple QP dot action, where Q is the dilaton over A dot and P is A squared minus A dot squared. What we see from this is that we have two simple options for our boundary conditions. One is that we can fix Q as T goes to infinity, where we prepare states Q of X, where we can view Q as T goes to infinity as corresponding to a state of the dilaton. The other option is that we can fix P as T goes to infinity, where we prepare states P of X. And this is the one that we will opt for. So our putative bulk Hilbert space is the span of these calligraphic P of X's. And recalling that P is related to the warp factor A by A squared minus A dot squared, and that the classical solutions can be written in this form with a C plus of X times E to the T and a C minus of X times E to the minus T, we know that the non-singularity of the bulk geometry requires that these C plus minuses be non-zero. Now, note also that this P of X can be straightened out with a large diffeomorphism. So in a similar fashion, as I discussed before, we can associate each of these P of X's with a constant P. And that is, there is, by a similar analysis, these P of X's all are equivalent, are fall in equivalence classes that are associated with a constant value of P. Now, the question similarly is, which values of P are allowed? Now, if we use this relation to rewrite the bulk metric in terms of P, we see that there are two different regimes. There's P greater than zero and P less than zero. The P greater than zero corresponds to bounce geometries, and the P less than zero corresponds to crunch geometries. And as such, if we only want to sum over smooth metrics, because we don't have any defects to soak up any curvature singularities, this forces us to have calligraphic P be greater than zero, namely that we are only interested in the bounces, not the singular crunches. As such, we see from here that this P is associated with alpha squared, namely this parameter which, this object which parameterizes the circumference of the bottleneck. So, here then, with the bulk Hilbert space is the span of these P's, these representatives of constant P's for P greater than zero. And as again, this P greater than zero is due to the restriction to smooth geometries. Now, since P is conserved by bulk evolution acts trivially on the P's. In other words, bulk evolution is simply the identity. This can be viewed as the fact that another way of viewing this, if you will, is that in quantum gravity, dynamics is trivial once you've kind of applied the Hamiltonian and other constraints. In the kind of constrained subspace of states, the dynamics can be viewed as trivial. Now, since P is equals alpha squared, or it can be associated with alpha squared, we can think about these P states as states of fixed bottleneck size, and we fix circumference around the bottleneck. Okay, so here's where we are so far. I will fill in now the last final piece of the bulk to asymptotic map. So we see already the suggestion that the asymptotic Hilbert space and the bulk Hilbert space are not equivalent to one another, or rather they almost look non-equivalent if little p and big P were canonically identified. In fact, we'll see that they are canonically identified in a moment. So the bulk to asymptotic map can be computed in the following manner. We can interpret the trumpet map as a map from the bulk Hilbert space to the asymptotic Hilbert space. So its matrix elements are given in the following way. If we have a calligraphic P state at the bottleneck and we end with a little P state here, this is just theta of P times delta of little p minus big P. That is, this map canonically identifies the P in the bulk and the P on the boundary in this case that that the P's are greater than zero. So in other words, what this V object actually is an isometry. If we compute V dagger V, this is just the identity on the bulk Hilbert space. But if we compute V dagger, then we actually get a projector onto the boundary Hilbert space, which projects us onto those states in which P is positive. Namely, it projects us onto precisely those states that do not end in a crunch, or rather that do not arise from a crunch at the bottleneck. So we see that in this very simple model, that because of the inequivalence of the bulk and asymptotic Hilbert spaces via their canonical identification because of this V map, that we see that the evolution from the bulk to the boundary is in fact given by an isometry. By an isometry, I just mean that this V object, that the definition of an isometry is a linear map, a complex linear map such that V dagger V is the identity and VV dagger is equal to a projector, which in fact is exactly what we have here. So we see the bulked asymptotic map as advertised is in fact an isometry. So here are the different ingredients. We have our asymptotic Hilbert space, we have our de Sitter S matrix, and we have our bulk Hilbert space. And by the bulked asymptotic map, we see that there is a canonical identification between the bulk Hilbert space and the boundary Hilbert space within this subspace of non-crunching geometries. So we see here that the bulk and asymptotic Hilbert spaces are different from one another, they are inequivalent, and that the de Sitter S matrix in this simple model is not unitary, but is in fact a projection. It projects out those states which crunch. So let's put everything together to make and then make some comments. So as I have said, the bulk and asymptotic Hilbert space in this simple model are unequal to one another. Moreover, the de Sitter JTS matrix is not unitary. It is given by a projector onto those states which do not arise from on precisely those states that correspond to smooth bulk geometries. Moreover, we'd still have unitarity within what I might call a code subspace of non-crunching states. That is, if we consider those states for which P is greater than zero, all of the dynamics is perfectly unitary. In fact, it's just the identity operator in that subspace. So within this particular subspace, everything works as normal in quantum gravity. And in fact, the dynamics is even trivial. And finally, we have a bulked asymptotic map, which is an isometry in the sense that V dagger V is equal to the identity in the bulk Hilbert space, but V dagger is equal to the de Sitter S matrix, which in fact is a projection. So let me, before I make an aside, let me say, are there any questions about this aspect of the story before I explore some implications of what this means?
I have a question. Would it be also possible to extend the bulk Hilbert space with a crunch state, but have a crunch state not further evolve into another asymptotic region?
So to have the crunch states, so one thing that I'll mention a bit later is that you can consider a generalization of JT gravity where you incorporate defects to soak up the curvature singularity. So in the theory without defects, these kinds of states are not allowed because they're not solutions to the equations of motion. But maybe to foreshadow what happens, it turns out that when you incorporate defects into JT gravity, not all cone angles are allowed. There's a spectrum of cone angles. And what you would find in that case is that the bulk Hilbert space has two parts. It has a part which is the bouncing geometries, which is this like P greater than zero region. And then it has this discrete series of allowed states at negative P, which correspond to the allowed values of the defect. But what's interesting there is that there, you can still sort of see encoded into the Bull-Kilbert space the spectrum of kind of allowed bottleneck, you know, allowed bulk geometries, the particular things in which you can crunch as well as those smooth geometries. But just to emphasize, to get those geometries to really work, the crunch ones, you have to incorporate defects to soak up the curvature. Does that address at least in part your question?
Yeah, I guess. Thank you.
Great.
I have a question about the setup of your model. I just want to understand your path integral better.
Yes.
At some point you mentioned you're summing over smooth geometries. Does that mean you're excluding non-smooth geometries from the path integral?
That's right. We're excluding non-smooth geometries. That's correct. But in particular, as I was just explaining, there is a natural way to include certain non-smooth geometries by modifying the theory to couple it, for example, to defects. It actually boils down to changing the dilaton potential, but because you need something to soak up the curvature. But yes, and what I have talked about, in the absence of defects, indeed, we are only summing over smooth geometries. Now, these can be, we're also summing, of course, over off-shell configurations too, but they're all smooth ones.
When you go to a mini superspace model later on, will you also stay within the smooth setting, or is it more general?
Yes, I will, but there will be something interesting in the mini superspace analysis. Yes, it'll still be smooth, but there will be a novelty in the mini superspace analysis, which I think is not usually done in mini superspace, which I will alert you to when we get there. But yes, it will still be smooth geometries. And I will comment at the very end about whether that in full-fledged quantum gravity in higher dimensions is a reasonable thing to do or not.
Okay, I'll wait for your comment.
Right. Certainly it's fine to do within this low dimensional model. This is a very sensible thing to do here. Whether it makes sense in 3+1 dimensions, let me table that for later, or what this might even mean in that context. But for now, let me make some comments. Oh, sorry, was there another question? Okay. So for now, let me make some comments on the Hartle-Hawking state. So here is a picture of the Hartle-Hawking state, or a cartoon of the Hartle-Hawking state, where what we do is we prepare some, we can view it in our language as preparing some Euclidean cap and then evolving it with this isometry. So the Hartle-Hawking state, which sort of is the final state up here, is this no boundary state where we then evolve it with an isometry. Now, in this picture, we can then, by applying V dagger, because V dagger V is the identity, we can obtain the bulk state. We can take the Hartle-Hawking state and we can evolve it backwards using V dagger and obtain the cap. And when you do this, okay, so here's a picture of the cap. And when we do this, we find that the cap state, at least in JT gravity, is non-normalizable. It's a delta function. It's actually the derivative of the delta function, localized at big P equals 1. So what we see is that this is non-normalizable, but it's, as you might have expected, it is a state which is heavily localized. In fact, delta function prime localized at the bottleneck equaling 1, or the circumference equaling 2 pi. In fact, the fact that it's non-normalizable can be seen in other computations. There's a paper up here that I've just flashed, in which they compute the sphere partition function in JT gravity, which is in fact divergent by the power that would be expected by taking the square of this and integrating it as a function of P. But I would like to point out that this picture is highly suggestive in the following manner. So let me draw our Hartle-Hawking state. Again, we start with Euclidean cap and we evolve it with V. Now, what we do is we want to compute the inner product of this state by sandwiching this V dagger on top of it. So that's Hartle-Hawking, taking the inner product with itself. And we can write it in this fashion, just the Euclidean cap times V dagger V times the Euclidean cap. And because the V dagger is the identity on the bulk Hilbert space, well, V and V dagger cancel out. Or in a picture, these cancel out. So we just get a sphere. So in particular, we might expect that the inner product of the Hartle-Hawking state with itself is just the sphere partition function in the appropriate dimension. Now, we can actually test that this works to one loop to one up, you know, including one loop effects in 3+1 dimensions. And this is work in progress with Harvey and Jensen. But I'd like to point out that this being true, the overlap of the Hartle Hawking state, equally including loop corrections to the sphere partition function, is something which is heavily suggested by this picture of isometries in any dimension. This is a simple way of sort of trying to convince yourself that this is a plausible answer to the overlap of the Hartle-Hawking state with itself. Of course, you have to check it. And that's what we're doing here. So let me make another aside on matrix integrals. This will be a very brief comment. So the JT de Sitter S matrix elements can be reproduced with a matrix model. So this is similar to, but slightly different from, the matrix model of Saad, Shanker, Stanford in their 2019 paper. So just to, the way you should think about this is that there's a statistical mechanical model of matrices, of D by D matrices, where in a particular way, you take the limit as the dimension of the matrices become large. You take D to infinity in a particular way. Now, it turns out that the far past to far future amplitude is encoded in this matrix model by this correlation function of what we call the half resolvents. This is this trace of square root of 2 over minus I h minus p. So in other words, that each S matrix amplitude that you can compute in JT gravity corresponds to a, there's a dictionary to amplitudes within this matrix model in the genus expansion or the Atuft expansion of the matrix model. What's interesting though, is that this result that we find a projector, you know, from mapping from the far past to the far future, actually has an interesting interpretation in the matrix model. Namely, it's something which is universal in double-scaled random matrix theory that is due to what is called the universality of the spectral form factor in random matrix theory. If that's unfamiliar, suffice it to say that it is interesting that this projector is something which random matrix theory knows about in a very deeply ingrained way, that something that is extremely universal in random matrix theory is precisely the same physics which is producing this projector, which we interpret from the bulk or from the gravity point of view, is projecting us onto states with smooth geometries and bottlenecks which are non-crunching. So now let me turn to mini superspace, which will be a shorter discussion, but hopefully a useful discussion. So let me discuss the mini superspace truncation of Einstein gravity. So we would like to build evidence for similar mechanisms that I've described to you in the context of Jacquive-Teitelbaum gravity, but now in higher dimensions, and you know, just ordinary Einstein gravity in higher dimensions. And when I say higher dimensions, I really have in mind 3+1 dimensions in particular. So let me write down Einstein gravity with a temporal gauge fixing. So here is the ordinary Einstein-Hilbert action with a positive cosmological constant. We'll, for simplicity, say that the cosmological constant is d times d minus 1 over 2. So that is, we're setting the de Sitter scale to be equal to 1. And then here what I've included is, this is the Lagrange multiplier. Here I've put in a gauge fixing term, which fixes us to a temporal gauge. That is, it's saying that the this is a perfectly valid gauge that we can consider in Einstein gravity, where the ti components or the it components of the metric, that is the spatial temporal components, are zero, are set to zero, and the tt component is set to one. This is a gauge that we are that is convenient in Einstein gravity, and there's also boundary terms. So let's now do a mini superspace truncation where I'm only going to consider the warp factor or metrics in which there's a warp factor in front of the dt squared term and a spatial sphere. And I'll parameterize them in the following way, e to the 2a of t, e to the 2b of t. And I'll further stipulate that the warp factors are only functions of t, and moreover, that the Lagrange multiplier is only a function of t. So this is the sense in which we will consider a mini superspace truncation of Einstein gravity. So if I do a change of variables, I'm just redefining these variables because they're particularly useful for us, the mini superspace action becomes this quantum mechanical model. We see that it looks like a particle given by y of t, which is in some potential, this is the shape of the potential, which depends on the dimension. And then there's these x's floating around in this Lagrange multiplier term, which sets x equal to 1. So to understand what's going on here, let's look at the equations of motion. The lambda equation of motion is simply the equation of motion that sets x equal to 1. So if we vary lambda, we set x equal to 1. Now, if we vary y, and then use the x equals 1 equation of motion to simplify, so if we vary y and then plug in x equals 1, we get this simple equation, y double dot equals minus v of y. This just looks like a y particle in a potential v of y. Finally, if we vary x, we get this equation of motion. We get that lambda is equal to 1/2 y dot squared plus v of y. That is, what it looks like is that we should be able to associate lambda with an energy. In other words, by virtue of this equation of motion, this right-hand side on shell will be constant. So we can associate lambda with being an energy, which is constant valued. Now, the key point is that usually what we do is that we consider solutions for which E equals 0. This then would correspond to the usual Hamiltonian constraint that we consider in Einstein gravity, here manifested as an avatar of it, is manifesting itself in the mini superspace truncation. However, in general, we're permitted to find solutions to these equations of motion in which E is not equal to 0, in which E essentially acts like a constant forcing term to the equations of motion. This corresponds to what you would call a constraint saddle in the language, for example, of Ian Affleck's paper on constraint instantons. So there's a richer family of solutions which involve the energy not being equal to 0, which correspond to a generalization, a constrained saddle version of the Hamiltonian constraint, which provides this constant forcing term. So the upshot of this is that the analysis of the model is very simple. Upon quantizing, we obtain a Hilbert space which is spanned by these states with constant energy. And moreover, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, if we visualize the potential by this blue curve, there's two different regimes. There is the regime in which these E's are greater than than the value of the maximum of the potential, which correspond to crunching geometries, which can go all the way down to 0. And then there's also these bounces, which correspond to E's, which are less than the max, in which the energies, in which there's a potential barrier. So what this means is that if you map out what the non-singular geometries correspond to, it corresponds to those states for which E is less than Vmax. So what the analysis shows is that the Bull-Hilbert space in this case, at least in this mini superspace truncation, is the span of these E states for E less than Vmax. So in this sense, even in this mini superspace truncation, we see that the Bull-Hilbert space is restricted upon considering non-singular geometries, namely those geometries that do not crunch. We see that there's a similar truncation of the Bull-Hilbert space, of the quantum Hilbert space, by virtue of the non-singularity condition.
Hi, Jordan, can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Hi, sorry to interrupt here. I thought it was a good point to interrupt.
Sure.
I have a question. How should I think of the E different than zero? So these are off-shell configurations? That's how I should think of it from the point of view of classical constraint gravity? Like off-shell configurations, or rather like solutions that are not that does not satisfy the constraints?
How do I say? So here's the point. Usually when we look at solutions to these kinds of equations, what we usually have in mind is that we consider solutions in which the Lagrange multiplier, which is E, which I've relabeled as E, is being set to zero. Mm-hmm. When it's set to zero, that means that the constraint term will not act as a forcing term to the residual terms in the action when we look at their variation. But what we're doing is we're considering these interesting solutions which have a non-zero VeV, saying VeV is too fancy. I just mean non-zero lambda. Okay. So, in other words, what we're doing is we're considering these kind of additional solutions to these equations of motion, which are the ones which have non-zero values of the Lagrange multiplier parameter. That is something which is unusual, and it is in general hard to find these kinds of solutions. These are called lambda solutions. You can find them, interestingly, in gauge theory and gravity. So let me actually give you another example. If you ever play around, it depends exactly how you do it, but if you look at things like sigma models, where there's you can instantiate them via constraint, there are certain ways of analyzing nonlinear sigma models in which you can consider the Lagrange multipliers picking up a vacuum expectation value, like, you know, the the constraint is imposed, but that term still acts like a forcing term for the kinetic terms in the equations of motion. If that's not familiar, I can try to give a different example, but this does arise in other example in other kinds of quantum field theories. It's just what's unusual here is that this constraint is arising from a gauge fixing constraint. This here is the residuals of this gauge fixing constraint we did in Einstein gravity, which fixed us to a temporal gauge. You can see examples in gauge theory and gravity where when you do a certain gauge fixing, you can consider certain solutions to the equations of motion in which the Lagrange multiplier is not equal to zero, and for which the gauge fixing term acts like a forcing term on the ordinary equations of motion. And in other words, it'll look like in the Einstein gravity, for the Einstein field equations, it'll look like there's a stress tensor term that's being generated by the constraint, which is acting like a forcing term. So I'd like to observe that this is a novel feature of the way that we've presented the mini superspace truncation, that usually what you do in the mini superspace truncation is that you don't do this gauge fixing. You just stipulate the warp factors and you don't put in this gauge fixing term. But by putting in the gauge fixing term, which is something very natural to do in the full-fledged Einstein gravity theory, that upon doing the mini superspace truncation, you see that you get these interesting constraint saddles in which, maybe calling them constraint saddles is a little bit overloaded here, because here they're just genuine, they're ordinary saddles, but in which you have a non-zero value of Lagrange multiplier. Sorry, that may have been too long of an answer to your question, but hopefully that.
Thank you very much.
I have a follow-up. Could you just summarize the difference between the ordinary mini superspace model and your models? So in comparison to ordinary mini superspace model, what conclusions hold? Which of your conclusions hold if you set to lambda to zero, and which conclusions do not hold?
So let me just make a quick observation. So if we set lambda to zero, this is essentially what you would think about as ordinary mini superspace. I mean, at least, well, depending on who you ask, it's mini superspace with a Hamiltonian constraint. Because let's see what happens. If E is set to zero, then the only two, the x equals one equation is uninteresting. We would just get this kind of quantum mechanics of the warp factor. And then we would get a constraint that its energy has to be equal to zero. And the only solutions to this are just the only solution to this is just the global de Sitter, the ordinary global de Sitter solution, just the warp factor being cosh squared of t. So the thing which is added here really is that, usually, again, it depends on who you ask, the usual mini superspace, let me go back a little bit to a previous slide, just so I can show you the move where we did it. You don't have this term that does the temporal gauge fixing. And usually you don't consider this e to the 2 a of t warp factor. I mean, well, it depends, maybe some people do, but
usually I think consider lapse and integrate over the value of the lapse.
Yeah, this is like the lab. Yeah, that's right. So I mean, yes, sometimes you do it and sometimes you don't. It just depends on who you, yes, that's right.
I mean, in your previous JT model, it seems you didn't. And
The JT model is a little more complicated because there's also a dilaton, which is essentially playing a similar role.
Okay. I'm not familiar with the model, but just as an outsider, it seems.
Well, in other words, this thing is, the lapse, I mean, it acts as a Lagrange multiplier type term, and that's also what the dilaton does in JT.
Okay.
It's a bit different.
The GT theory, but what about this model?
In this model, I mean, essentially, the x is coming from this e to the at term. This is the thing which is essentially enforcing the Hamiltonian constraint.
Right. And you're about to say what makes a difference if you put lambda not equal to zero, right?
Well, if lambda is equal to zero, then the only solution to these equations of motion is simply the global de Sitter. But now I'm saying there's actually a whole family of solutions if you allow E to be non-zero. And yes. They conclude that's the new thing. That's the new ingredient. In other words, if E is equal to zero, there's only one thing you can choose. It's just Y equals cosh squared of T. But if it's not, then you can get this whole range of warp factors, which include basically cosh squared of T sort of generalizations of cosh squared of T where kind of you have larger bottlenecks and also smaller bottlenecks that go down to a crunching geometry.
To drive it home to your main message, does setting lambda not equal to zero make a difference about isometry and unitarity?
Yes. It shows you that
there's... That makes a difference.
Well, what all we're saying here, because we don't really know what the measure is supposed to be or how we should really deal with the measured mini superspace, that's a little bit of a tricky question. Here, I'm only making the point that we see that there is this Hilbert space of states which are labeled by E, and that if we only want to consider smooth bulk geometries, that there is a truncation of the naive Hilbert space of the bulk into the region of E's that are less than this Vmax and those that are greater than the Vmax. And the ones that we should select out if we want non-singular geometries are those with E greater than Vmax, less than Vmax. So this is just a similar way in which the bulk Hilbert space is sort of being reduced into the subspace of states that correspond to non-singular bulk geometries. This is not as comprehensive in any means as the analysis of the JT theory, because we don't really know how to deal. We could do so if we stipulated what the measure should be, but kind of I want to be a little bit agnostic about the measure here and just talk about things at the level of the Hilbert space.
Just one final question. I'm not familiar with your potential V. So if I consider a theory with a positive cosmological constant, is V max positive or negative or zero?
I would have to think about it. I'm not sure off the top of my head. Maybe someone else.
V max is positive. But I'm also a bit confused about allowing non-vanishing lambda. I mean, I understand your motivation, because if you look just at the zeta, then you have only one state, no?
Yeah.
And so you could get more states by introducing some kind of matter. And so it seems more like you have introduced some peculiar kind of matter. Can I understand it this way? I mean...
Well, how do I say? I mean, so... If you do this in full-fledged Einstein gravity, which we did in some previous paper for other reasons, you can view it as this is a way of looking at off-shell, this is a controlled way of looking at a constrained saddle approximation in full-fledged Einstein gravity to off-shell geometries, which are and essentially in which the constraint term is sourcing like a TT component of the stress tensor. So in other words, what the you can view this in full-fledged Einstein gravity as a way of integrating over a controlled way over off-shell geometries. It's a valley. It's essentially this valley in which there's this constraint direction, which is a direction in which if you vary it, you go off-shell. But in all of the other directions in field space, the action is quadratically stable. I can explain that more later, but essentially once you go down to mini superspace, it just becomes, you don't see any of that structure anymore because you've reduced it too much.
Okay.
But yeah, maybe let me skip these comments about ADS Euclidean wormholes for the moment and let me just conclude with the discussion. So in summary, and we can talk more about these issues in a bit, that the S matrix need not be unitary in quantum gravity, and that the bulk and asymptotic Hilbert spaces need not match, in particular the crunching initial conditions live in an asymptotic Hilbert space, but not in what I will call the code subspace of bulk states. Now, complete knowledge of bulk physics, even on arbitrarily large timescales, is not enough to deduce the de Sitter S matrix. This is just another way of reorganizing the words of the fact that bulk Hilbert space does not tell you at any finite time what is going on with asymptotic Hilbert space, that there's different calculations and they even have kind of different moduli space integrals. So in our examples, evolution is trivial within the code subspace, namely the subspace of non-crunching geometries, which is sort of akin to what happens in, you know, gravity once you've imposed the constraints, like in Wheeler-DeWitt. And this breakdown of unitarity is invisible in perturbation theory and only arises non-perturbatively, namely by doing these integral over moduli spaces. So let me conclude with some comments and speculations. So one question is, so I believe that all of these things, so also a piece of work in progress, is to generalize some piece of this story to 2+1 space-time dimensions. Of course, gravity in 2+1, pure gravity, quantum gravity, is sort of also special in 2+1 dimensions as it is in 1+1 dimensions. So the real question is, does it work in 3+1 dimensions and higher? That's a case which is qualitatively different. So the mini superspace analysis is promising, but there is a question that we need to alert ourselves to, which is the restriction to a sum over smooth geometries realized in UV completions of De Sitter quantum gravity, for example, such as string theory? And the issue is that, for instance, maybe certain singular metrics that are sensible, say in string theory, ought to be included in the low energy theory. In other words, there are certain singular metrics which we should include for reasons that are beyond the purview of IR effective field theory. So as I mentioned, there's a useful toy model, which is De Sitter JT gravity coupled to defects, which can source these cone angles at the bottleneck. And what you find is that the Bull-Hilbert space, in fact, encodes a spectrum of viable geometric configurations. In other words, not all cone angles for the defects are allowed, but only certain ones are allowed. And this means that the Bull-Hilbert space encodes that information. That is to say, it would be as if the actual physical Hilbert space of our universe encodes only those viable initial conditions on which the universe could have begun, which are not all kind of singular geometries, but a select assortment of these geometries, which would be encoded into the nature of the Hilbert space or the subspace in which we live. So we can also consider various models of gravity coupled to matter, and that will give a richer way of there'll be more interesting ways in which you can prepare combinations of gravities and gravity and matter, which will terminate in, or begin in a crunch. A tantalizing question, by the way, is one might want to try to connect these to questions about black holes, such as the proposal of Mandelson and Horowitz in 03. But let me just flash one last slide, and then I'll conclude and can take questions. So we expect that the true Hilbert space of De Sitter quantum gravity is drastically smaller than indicated by its semi-classical description. And in fact, holographic arguments suggest that it's non-perturbatively finite. I believe that these findings are a first step in this direction, where we can already see the pruning of the Bull-Hilbert space in the low energy effective description. And I believe that at least some version of the mechanism that I have tried to explain here will persist ultimately in higher dimensional models of quantum gravity in enabling and facilitating this pruning of the Hilbert space. So with that in mind, thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Roland. You have to be clear. Let's start with question by student. If there is any, so if you are a student and have a question, please switch on your camera and ask your question. I don't see any, so go for it, Bianca.
Yeah, thanks, John, for this nice talk. Well, I have two questions or possibly comments. I mean, one is that there's a hope in quantum gravity that we resolve singularities and possibly big crunch. So if you exclude them, you know, or even from the, well, and you exclude them at least from the Bull-Hilbert space in some sense, but no configuration which actually leads to a crunch is even allowed to evolve in some sense. So in some sense, you are not allowed to ask the question if you can get singularity resolutions for these, no?
Well, so I think that the perspective, so let me come at this from a perspective, maybe a slightly stringy perspective, which the thing which I might guess is a speculation is that, Okay, well, just in general, in any gauge theory or gravity theory, is that if you want kind of a gauge field or a gravitational field to end, it has to end on some extended object, like a brain of some kind. So there is some kind of object. I think that if we have something like a Big Bang singularity on which we want space-time to end or begin, some kind of brain-like object. So the thing that I am imagining, which I'm viewing this JT gravity coupled to defects as some toy model or proxy for, is that what we should really kind of consider is a theory of gravity where we couple it to these kinds of brains or extended objects on which space-time can end, or rather in this case, begin or crunch or whatever you want to say. And that in such cases, there can still be restrictions that are imposed on us by quantization on these kinds of extended objects, these brain-like objects. And as such, that the structure of the Bohr-Hilbert space, it does allow us to crunch or to begin in a Big Bang, but only in, but only in ways which are restricted by the quantization or the appropriate interpretation of the brain-like objects themselves. In other words, there can still be restrictions of the Bohr-Hilbert space if there are limited possibilities, or there is a constraint on the possibilities of the kinds of extended objects on which the universe can begin or end. And I don't have any particularly concrete ideas about this except in this very toy model of JT coupled to defects, but that's the way in which I envision this story in generalizing, because in other words, if we allowed all possible kind of crunch configurations, then the story, we wouldn't really know how to compute it and the story would be trivialized. But I think what really will happen is that there's only kind of a certain set of ways that we will hopefully ultimately find in which space-time can begin or crunch. And that will be encoded into the details of the Bohr-Hilbert space. But that at the moment is just a speculation.
Mm-hmm. And in the GT model, you had boundary gravitons, but they played no role whatsoever in the scattering matrix. So is that what you expect also in higher dimensions, in particular in 3+1?
So in 3+1 dimensions, while there's no boundary gravitons, there is still so something which is arising in, for example, this computation of this one loop computation of the norm of the Hartle-Hawking state, is that there's still a non-trivial path integral that you have to do to get the norm on asymptotic states in pure gravity in 3+1 dimensions, even in effective field theory. And what that arises from essentially is that you want to get a delta function which is invariant under Diff mod Weil. Okay. And it turns out that there is still a non-trivial path integral, sort of non-trivial moduli that you have to do that's not due to boundary gravitons, but is still due to integrating over fluctuations of the space-time, which give you the correctly invariant inner product. So in other words, even though the boundary gravitons don't directly accommodate for the inner product in higher dimensions, a very similar analysis does. And maybe to say it in a different way, the boundary gravitons in a certain sense are giving us, if you remember in this inner product, there's a prefactor, which it's like root phi one phi two times delta mm-hmm. phi one plus minus phi two. The prefactor sort of is due to the boundary gravitons, but what's really interesting sort of in higher dimensions is that the actual delta function is a bit more interesting because it has to be an object which is invariant under Diff mod Weil, and that's actually kind of the manner in which this analysis generalizes to higher dimensions. I can tell you more details of that, but that's the high level picture.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Let's maybe take just one brief last question, but we can continue discussing after. So, thank you, right?
You. I'd like to understand your mini superspace path integral better. How exactly do you define the path integral? What sense are you restricting to smooth geometries?
Well, what I'm doing is I am restricting to those geometries in which the warp factor does not become negative or zero.
So sorry, what is the warp factor?
It is, I can show you, but just to say it is the function which lies in front of the part of the metric. So in other words, the metric is minus dt squared plus warp factor times metric on the sphere or the d sphere. And you do not want that to become negative. You do not want the warp factor in front of the sphere part to become zero or negative. That corresponds to a crunch.
Okay.
Right. Just at level, just as a metric, it's a singular metric.
In general, even if I allow the work factor, even if I enforce the work factor to be non, to be positive, I can still have non-smooth geometries in the path integral.
Well, how do I say? There are in this model the way in which the in at least in yes I agree in full-fledged Einstein gravity, but in mini superspace, just because this thing corresponds to a single particle, that's the way, that's the only way, at least in this quantum mechanical model, in which these things can arise. It's sort of like trajectories of the particle that kind of that can hit zero.
So your metric is parameterized by capital A and capital B, and then somehow you need to do a path integral. So what variables are you integrating over?
I'm integrating over all the variables. It's just that, how do I say? The point is that, how do I say? The only dynamical variable, maybe this is the thing which has a derivative acting on it, which is just the y, which is related to the B warp factor. That's the only dynamical variable. That's the only thing that has a kind of a kinetic term. By virtue of the constraints, how do I say? Yes, you're integrating over all of the variables, but the point is that the analysis which I have been trying to show you is one that is not too terribly sensitive to the choice of the path integral measure, which I think is not so clear when you go down to mini superspace. Maybe we can talk about this in more detail. And I think I understand what you're asking, but I think I need to show you some more equations. I think you're asking literally, how do you do the path integral?
How do I define it?
I think maybe we can cut the official seminar and we can leave the Zoom open. So if you want to continue, guys, talking about that, maybe it's easier. So thanks again, Jordan, for his talk. Thank you very much. It was very interesting. And see.